You're listening to 89.5 KPOO San Francisco, and welcome to Reality Sandwich, where every Thursday at noon we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, the body, the planet, our spiritual connections, the health of economy, all six areas of the Healthful Living model, which you can read about at healthfulliving.org. My name is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist, and joining me shortly on the show today will be my wife and co-host, Julie Matthews, certified holistic nutrition consultant. And today's show is going to be all about ADD, the 20-hour solution. We've done some past shows on this subject, and Julie's had some other guests in talking about ADD, demystifying what this is. You know, it's hitting so many of our children and adults now all across the country. Really just the rates going through the roof over the past 5, 10, 15 years. So there's definitely something going on in all kinds of different approaches of treatment. Today we're very fortunate to have on the line with us Dr. Siegfried Ottmer. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that correctly. Let's just first make sure he's on the line. Are you there with us?
Yes, indeed.
Hi there. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Ottmer, that's correct.
Ottmer. Now, you're the chief scientist at the EEG Institute of the Brian Ottmer Foundation in Woodland Hills and co-author of the book ADD, the 20-Hour Solution, Training Minds to Concentrate and Self-Regulate Naturally Without Medication. Now, I can't tell you how much that sounds pleasing to us here, because we're really all about helping people to identify natural approaches to understanding how their body works, how their minds work, and using the most cutting-edge knowledge and techniques that we have to help restore harmony in the body without the need to be signed on to long-term medication, i.e. an external influence to help our bodies run. So I would like, let's just start right off, please, Mr. Ottmer, please, if you could just give our audience a little bit of background, who you are, where you're coming from, and how it is that you got involved in this book. I read here that you are a physicist, but then you have two children with neurological impairments, and so how do you come to be here chatting with us today?
Yes, well, it's a strange journey. I did get started in life as a physicist, experimental physicist, and then went into aerospace. But life is what happens when you're making other plans.
Sure.
And in our case, it was two children with severe neurological problems. The significant one here in our life was Brian, who ultimately was identified with a seizure disorder. But that wasn't really the half of it. That was the kind of thing that called attention to itself, because he became occasionally violent and that kind of thing. So he had unexplained rages and violent behavior, quite sudden onset, and they were uncharacteristic of him. It's not the way he wanted to be. So it was absolutely bizarre, and the problem was that professionals really didn't understand what was going on, except in a kind of seizure model. So neurologists, for example, they understand seizures, but they don't understand rambunctious behavior. That's not their interest. So for a while, the problem started being, you know, was being written off as simply extreme behavior. But then it became, when actual seizure behavior showed up, actual seizures, then it was realized this was a neurological problem.
Mm.
And for us, this became kind of ultimately leaping forward became a kind of a paradigm of behavior in children that they can neither control nor do they wish it. It's brain behavior.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened in the last 20 years of our involvement in this technique, we've learned to understand how much of children's behavior is in that nebulous realm between the will and the physiology. It is adaptive behavior, adaptable behavior. It's behavior that can respond to interventions, so it's not fixed, but it's also not particularly subject to the will. Our son was just very upset with himself at the way he behaved. In fact, he wanted to kill himself. He said, you know, a person like me wasn't meant to be alive.
Mm.
And so childhood depression was another thing that he was wrestling with. And we as parents were kind of just bystanders here. We were just as mystified as everybody else. We did our usual parenting thing, but it didn't touch these behaviors. And so, on the other hand, you know, we're being parents and trying to control the behavior. The child gets the message, you know, I ought to be in charge of this,
right,
but I'm not. And so the child condemns himself. So in retrospect, we realize that our being, putting these demands on our son, which he had no way of meeting, we were, in fact, unnecessarily hard on him in terms of crushing his own resources of recovery. So, you know, the behavioral methods that we were using weren't particularly helping the situation.
Right. Now, do you find this is a pretty consistent pattern with a lot of kids that are dealing with ADD, that we get caught in this pattern where, like you say, it's not necessarily something that they have, you know, direct willful control over, and hence they themselves are, you know, discontent, and they're aware of their behavior, they don't like it, and then here we are as society or adults, as parents, negatively punishing them, right, for this ill behavior, and that creates a cycle of them then blaming themselves for, in a way, I mean, you know, there's all kinds of things that we can say negatively inside, you know, I should know better, I'm a bad person, you know, I'm getting all these messages that my behavior is wrong, right, yet I'm not able to control it. So, like you say, we then end up quashing their own resource and capability to intervene here, yeah?
Right. So, basically, what happens is, it's not so much that the child is necessarily aware of their own behavior, but they're aware of the negative world reaction. You know, in their family, he gets dinged. At school, he gets dinged, and other kids respond. So that's what he's sensitive to. He may not be aware of his own activities that give rise to all that. I mean, kids don't show up at the doc saying, "Doc, help me, I'm hyperactive." You know, So they don't really understand their situation. It mystifies them, but what they do know is that the world is turning hostile to them.
Right.
And so now, with recognizing that there is something, that there is this whole realm here of behavior that is becoming clear to us, that's becoming understandable, and that we can learn to influence, that's been essentially the story of neurofeedback. And in a sense, medication is just part of that story. Medication is one way to influence behavior, and it turns out there are a lot more besides. And when we use those other ways of dealing with brain behavior, it turns out medication largely falls by the wayside.
Mm. What's your take? Let's just step back for a quick second and cover here. What's your take on why the frequency of this has increased so much over the past years, or is that just our ability to observe?
No, the children's literature goes way back in terms of identifying children who quite clearly fit the pattern. A couple hundred years ago. So the children's literature tells us. Pediatric literature tells us that, but the incidence is clearly going up. We're seeing a major increase in the most extreme childhood behaviors. Bipolar. Now we're calling people bipolar, calling the children bipolar. That used to almost not exist, and now it's plentiful. Our office is routinely seeing children who are labeled bipolar, and that just was unheard of. 30 years ago. So things are clearly getting worse. We're seeing a major increase in autism, increased probably by close to a factor of 100 within our lifetime, or my lifetime. And that used to be quite rare. Now it's commonplace.
What's going on?
A number of factors. There are clearly stressors in our environment that we're only beginning to recognize. And that's not what I'm an expert on, but let me just at least mention them. And that, of course, is what's happening to our diet, the food intolerances, and so forth. Vaccines come into this with regard to autism in particular.
Mm-hmm.
There are greater immune system stressors. And then there are the things that are missing from our diet and so forth. So it's actually a multifaceted picture that drives ADD. And we've emphasized neurofeedback for ADD because that is actually the area where we can do the most good, you know, the most bang for the buck. We can go furthest in terms of remediating the childhood problems with essentially one solution. But what we're certainly not saying that makes it unnecessary to take care of these other things, like the dietary issues, heavy metal toxicities,
right.
The digestive tract, you know, absorption of whole absorption issue. There's a whole raft of issues, and so the medical approach is too single-minded in its focus. Not only does it neglect neurofeedback, but it neglects all these other things that should be paid attention to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a riddle in and out, and so that's it's not only our own view of the world that is being neglected in the medical model. It's 95% of what's going on with ADD is being neglected in the single-minded approach.
It's just absolutely shocking when we hear that. I mean, we've talked quite a bit on the show. One of Julie's specialties is actually working with autism, specifically the biomedical approach and the nutritional interventions for autism. And, you know, that's an area where she's, you know, constantly, like you say, you know, the medical arena looks at that as strictly a neurological issue and just doesn't look at all these other consistent factors that are happening, you know, biologically and you know, in the body, that need to be addressed as well. So I hear that with ADD, as we're talking about now, there are issues both physiologically and biologically and then also neurologically. And if I follow you, that one of the most effective ways to ultimately affect behavior is working with this neurological arena with biofeedback. And is biofeedback and neurofeedback the same?
Well, it's essentially the same thing. Let me tell you what happened here. It used to be called EEG biofeedback, and in many quarters still is. But what had happened with biofeedback is that it had become sort of accepted by medicine in one sense, but it becomes sort of domesticated. People thought of it in terms of just relaxation training. And the whole idea of relaxation training became trivialized. You know, you have the thought in mind of lying on a hammock with an umbrella, with somebody serving you an umbrella drink, when you think about relaxation. And so biofeedback, which sort of arose some 30 years ago in this country, was essentially sidelined and didn't affect medicine at its core. And that I think was a grievous error. But that's what happened, and that's the history. So when EEG biofeedback came along, people said, look, we need to have a term that differentiates this from what people have in their head when they think of biofeedback. This is not just relaxation training. But the fact is, neither is biofeedback. Biofeedback, you know, is actually training in control. It's trying to teach your brain, your nervous system, better control of its own affairs. And when we use EEG biofeedback, when we use look at the EEG, here we just have more signal to work with. When we look at the EEG, we see the brain at work, doing its business of regulation. Of you know, the central nervous system task can be thought about as basically a task in communication. Or just for the moment, let's take that perspective, that it's that we're talking about the brain communicating with itself. It's the brain is kind of a beehive of activity with communications going every which way, and most of it we don't know about, right? More than 99% of that activity, in fact, probably 99.99% of the activity of the brain does not reach consciousness and is beyond our awareness, and it just sort of goes on.
Mm-hmm.
But we can still influence it by making it visible. And what we can do much like a mother who shapes her child's behavior because she's watching the behavior, we can go one level down. We can go and watch the brain's behavior, and we can manipulate it. We can challenge the brain to move to patterns of internal behavior that are more suitable, more appropriate, and more competent.
That sounds spot on to me with regards to, in a way, reprogramming or giving, I shouldn't use the word reprogramming as much as giving ourselves the feedback. You get this reading, right? And then begin to understand how we can consciously impact what's showing up in those readings for the purpose of, I guess it is training ourselves. Can you, let's just jump into an example of how this would work. What does it look like? Does somebody sit down and get plugged in? Let's just use an example and make up a scenario of,
yeah,
you know, of a child or an adult who's going to sit down and do
yeah.
this.
Yeah. Well, just briefly, a child who comes in for one of our sessions for attention deficit disorder would have about three electrodes mounted on their scalp with a little conductive paste.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to notice, to observe at this point, that we don't put anything into the brain, nothing into the head. All we're doing is observing. We're simply measuring. Nothing goes in except by the five senses. So we just measure this EEG. The clinician looks at that, sets some goals about, happens to relate to these EEG frequencies. Some we favor, some we disfavor. We notice, observe certain bursts of activity that we may not like, that we may see as reflecting the dysregulation in that brain,
mm-hmm.
and we simply call attention to it. So we massage the data, and then feed it right back to the child in the form of a video game, or some other abstraction, some other abstract symbols, mathematical symbols, or geographical figures, that kind of thing. And we're basically saying, make the game go faster, make the light brighter, make the box bigger, or whatever. Something that encodes our reward criteria so that the child knows where better lies. So this is actually simply a very sophisticated game of warmer, colder. We lead the brain again back and forth. The brain goes back and forth on its own. And we keep giving it indication of how to change, how to move to where it suits our objectives more than it did a moment ago. So it's this continuous game of warmer, colder that gradually leads the brain toward better brain behavior.
Now, what is the child who is connected to this? What are they doing in their mind or with this interaction? They're guided to, you know, a warm or cold circumstance. So something's happening, and let's just say it becomes warm, and they want to affect it towards cold. What are they doing? Are they visualizing? Are they doing? What are they doing in their mind?
We are in the age of global warming, and so right now we would all like for it to be a little cooler. But the fact is, the warmer colder analogy that I grew up with was everybody wanted to get warmer. But what the child is doing is actually very simple. We're very competitive beings, and you give us a goal, and we try to meet that goal. And even if the child doesn't know what that goal relates to, the child needs to have no knowledge of the fact that this has to do with their own hyperactivity or their own rages or their migraines or their bedwetting. The child just wants to make the game go. Because we're giving them points, and they try to accumulate points, and they try to make a goal of 1,000 points in a 30-minute session, and we set the level of difficulty so that they, if they apply themselves in that 30 minutes, they're going to get to the goal. We just want them to apply themselves, and if they goof off and so forth, then they have to stay a little longer or something like that, or they don't make the goal. So that's the kind of feedback. So they are basically looking at this at the conscious level. Look, I just want Pac-Man to go. I want Pac-Man to eat dots. I want to get scores. I want to get beeps and so forth. And once you've internalized those goals from our games, which happens quite readily, quite rapidly, if you start making the game more difficult and you start taking scores away, they'll become very irritated with you. So definitely we've got buy-in from these kids. They want scores. Now, when you have an adult in the chair, it's very different. The adult might say, well, you know, my kids know how to play video games, but I'm really not very good at this. Can I do this? And we have to get the adult to kind of back off and say, look, this isn't really about video games. This isn't really about, anything except showing you information about how your brain is doing. So relax. But the adult has difficulty relaxing because we've all gone through school. We've all tried to get better grades. And so we have difficulty just accepting that.
Mm-hmm.
But to the adult, we have to say, this is like meditation. You know, this is like meditation for the brain. Just be with this game. Be in the room with it. Watch the video game proceed. You're essentially just witnessing your brain in action.
Mm-hmm.
And be pleased with yourself when you succeed. And don't try too hard. I mean, you want the success, but all you need to do is want it. The brain will do the rest. It's not like you can't force it. And so this is really happening at the brain level. So that's the really a crucial point. You see, our conversation is really with the brain. And the thing is that we have to keep the child sitting happily in the chair while we're talking to his brain. And we do that with fancy video games and stuff like that. But the real object is not to please the child. The object is for us to communicate with their brain. And that's a very tight feedback loop where the brain gets information about itself. And now we're favored by nature in the following way. The brain likes information about itself. It is, in a sense, a very narcissistic organ. You know, the brain, if the brain sees something in its outer world, the brain is busy making sense of our sensory world, right? It's always trying to figure this out, put it in place, and we don't notice how complex this project actually is because the brain does such a good job of it. But when the brain observes information in the outside world that links up with information inside, it's intrigued. It says, what's going on out there? That's the game out there is wiggling when something wiggles inside the skull, and the brain, in the more mathematical sense, is like a correlation engine, right?
Mm-hmm.
It detects correlations internally. That's how it works mathematically, but it works that way in at another level too. It forms an internal map of what we see of the outside world, right? What we see in the outside world is really playing inside our brains. And so the brain has, in a sense, remapped our experience. So it's in this conversation with the outside world all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And if part of that conversation, it's a part of what it witnesses, just absolutely tracks what's going on in a certain locale in the skull, the brain is gripped by it. It says, my goodness, you know, this is me. And our narcissistic organ up there is it's like looking in a mirror,
mm-hmm.
and it gets captured, and then of course we want it to succeed more, and it bites into that and so forth. But this is happening at the brain level.
So we're then able to give it feedback, or in a way begin to shape its experience and give it new references for responses at certain points and certain levels, right? If I'm just talking out loud here, right? That if the brain is now going off, you've indicated that a particular level somewhere is, you know, something that you want to reduce, and then that gets calibrated back into the game, and then the player of the game is now naturally behaving to reduce that just based on their interaction with the game, and now the brain gets reference of that response, right?
Yeah.
Versus no response or just continuing its old pattern. So in a way, we're giving the brain and these patterns new resources, new options, new ways of being.
Right, right, and you know, just like with ordinary behavioral techniques, we give the brain a lot of attaboys,
mm-hmm.
and a few no goes. Oh, you can't go there.
Right.
You know, so we have a few boundaries which the brain in its EEG should not transgress. And whenever it does so, we call attention to it and says, okay, as long as you're hanging out in this space, no reward.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, we're giving it attaboys. You know, keep going, keep it up, this is good, this is better, you know. We're playing in the margins. We're subtly moving it. It's these tiny little nudges, a gazillion nudges in over a 30-minute period that nudge the brain just incrementally in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Because you really want to work largely with positive feedback, not with, proscriptions, thou shalt not go there.
Right, right. Yes, the brain naturally responds more to positive reinforcement than in the notion of avoidance, which is where, unfortunately, most of us spend most of our regular life in, you know, avoiding things, avoiding negative outcomes, rather than being aligned where the true power is in moving towards what
right.
it is we want in positive reinforcement.
Right.
The basic laws of conditioning and repetition of behavior over time are innate in really the creation of everything that happens behaviorally, and here we are having this amazing ability to use that with intention to help teach the brain patterns that are healthier for the individual.
Right, right. And of course, one of the life experiences of the ADD child is that they get a lot of negative feedback from the world at large.
Right.
And here we put him, just stuff him into an environment, him or her, into an environment where most of the feedback is positive, right? So the child is going to warm up to that. Here they're absolutely succeeding. And every time they come in, they now are succeeding, most likely, if we're successful and do our job, more than before. And, of course, we adjust the level, so we keep the level of difficulty actually constant. But their body senses that they're more comfortable within their own skin. They're more comfortable in interaction with other people, and so forth.
Right. You're listening to 89.5 KPOO San Francisco Reality Sandwich. We are on today with Dr. Siegfried Othmer, and we're speaking all about ADD and specifically EEG biofeedback approaches for training the mind to concentrate and self-regulate naturally without medication. Let's just jump now back into our scenario with we were just talking about, you know, an average child working with these sessions, and you mentioned 30 minutes. Can you give us a little bit more of just the overview protocol for someone coming in to embrace this approach?
Yeah, well, the protocol is actually fairly straightforward. It turns out that there is an incredible variability in how people respond to this training.
Mm.
And so what one practitioner in our practitioner network has called this is that the basic mission of the therapist in our approach to this is to kind of find the sweet spot where the person does well. And let me give you an analogy here. We all learned this in the playground when we push somebody on the swing. We have to be in phase with the swing. We have to push the swing just at the right moment in order to get the amplitude of the swing to build up, right? To swing at larger excursions.
Right.
And so now nobody has to explain that to us. We get it right from the start. But that principle actually applies quite broadly, and in the brain, we're dealing with a similar resonance system, which operates at a lot of different resonant frequencies. So the swing in the playground, for example, can be thought of as it's a resonant system. It has its resonant frequency, and in order to make it go, you have to interact at that resonant frequency. The same thing is true of the brain, except that there are lots of frequencies, and they're all doing their own thing, and all minding their own business and all doing what they have to do, and then they sort of come and go. They appear on the scene to do their thing, and then they vanish again. But at almost any time, you can take a snapshot, and almost all of these frequencies will be active at a particular time. So we engage with these particular frequencies, and we find out that some people are so sensitive to this. We have to train them at particular frequencies in order to keep them happy. That is, they feel good with it and so forth. Now, ADD children are not particularly sensitive. Because they don't tell us, we can be wildly off and they're still okay with it. But we still try to find the frequency that is best for them, most effective for the training, and that's been called a sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
By a practitioner in Dallas who works with bipolar children. So she came up with that term, and it kind of expresses what's really going on. We find where the person responds best to this kind of training. And the other you think of as a kind of gating, that whenever the EEG makes an excursion into dysregulation, we have to detect it and then say, okay, thou shalt not go there. And we, as I said, we only do a little bit of that, but that's the other part. So it's training at this resonant frequency where we give the brain a slight push. We say, make this EEG frequency bigger than it was a minute ago. Try to make it increase it in size, much like giving the swing a push in the playground.
Right. Now, how many sessions does somebody require? What's typical?
With ADD, we've kind of learned learned the tricks of the trade. So quite often we will actually bring things to a reasonable completion by 20 sessions. I would rather people think in terms of 40 sessions, however, and the 20-hour solution in the title of that book has to do actually refers to 40 sessions. It refers to 40 half-hour sessions.
Mm-hmm.
So 20 sessions on 20 hours on the instrument, 40 half-hour sessions. But the reason for the caution is we tend to see now more extreme children than we used to. Where if we were to see a garden variety ADD child, 20 sessions might very well be enough. But that's not what we see anymore. We now see children with conduct disorder and oppositionality, and they're difficult to manage, and there's violence and rages, and maybe it doesn't rise to the level where they're labeled with bipolar disorder, but it's a more complicated issue than we used to see 10, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're seeing children who are much more of a challenge to their parents, and so whereas we are doing a better job than we did 10 years ago, the fact is, with these more difficult children, we probably can't get it done in 20 sessions. Now, people will be very happy with where they are 20 sessions in, but they will also realize, once they realize what's doable here, they say, I want more. What more is there? And they should probably think in terms of 40 sessions more realistically.
Now, is this a matter of going to a particular clinic, or is it a device that people can buy? I mean, how do people that are listening now who may not even realize, that this option exists for them or have had some intrigue, what do parents do or what do individuals do to learn more about this?
Yeah.
And do
Well, there are some home training options, but that's, this is something we've spent now our last 20 years of our professional lives, my wife and I, on this.
Mm-hmm.
And every day we learn in the clinic, and every day we learn how to do this better. The idea of somebody doing this on their own, I think it's just not advisable. It's a little bit like sort of titrating your own medications, and I'll take it from here kind of thing. The home training option is probably more for people who don't get the job done in 40 sessions, where we're dealing with more continuing issues, where a child may have had meningitis in childhood, or there may be cerebral palsy, or autism spectrum. With autism, we do wonderful work with autism now, but we're not done in 40 sessions. So in order not to bankrupt the family, we arrange for them to continue at home.
Sure.
But we will have seen them for 20 sessions at least in the office, where we've gotten acquainted with the child, where we realize what training they need. Now the parents have witnessed the process. They've learned how we do it. Now they're going home empowered. They're going home equipped with an entirely different understanding of their child and of the situation and of what needs to be done. And now they might as well sit with their child at home as sit at the office. And so after some period of time where the parents are teed up, we're perfectly happy to send them home with the equipment. They can just rent it, and they get continuing advice from us. We take care of all the particulars. They We get them all the supplies they need and so forth, and technical advice if their equipment bellies up or the software, you know, has a problem. They talk to our technical people and so forth. We support them, and for that, that's all for one rental price, and until they finish up,
mm-hmm.
and then they just give the equipment back, and so forth. Now there are some other related techniques that people can sort of do on their own, but it's a trade-off. Those techniques that light and sound stimulation systems, they can just buy a unit and do something. But this is really, I think, where you're talking about the rest of your child's life, and this is just not something that they ought to get wrong. And
right.
The only people who should consider starting out with home use are people who are in an economic position where they simply have no alternative.
So if not home use, they're going to a clinic, and or is that...
Right. You start out with a clinic,
mm-hmm.
For about 20 sessions to have the clinician get thoroughly acquainted with their child and work out whatever needs to be done, and then they can turn the crank at home. We have no problem with that. They would do that in continuing consultation with a clinician. We had an autistic child. I just got to tell you about this.
It's sure.
just totally amazing. We got started last summer, and the child was the usual difficult autistic child. You know, not much eye contact and so forth. He was in his own world. No verbal ability, and didn't like the training. Right, so we go through our usual thing of getting the child comfortable with the training. We crank out 20 to 40 sessions, turn the thing over to home use, and we're in an occasional contact with the mom, and we realize progress is happening. But we had no idea of actually how far that had come. I mean, the mother had been telling us, but it's not like seeing it. So after some 8 or 9 months, the kid comes in again in order for us to test him now. It was time for sort of a retest to get a calibration on just how well he was doing. Well, this kid flew through the door and flew into the arms of the therapist and hugged the therapist.
Mm.
And, the therapist, you know, had last seen the kid 8 months before, and this was a different kid, you know. And it had all happened at home.
Wow.
I mean, we'd made progress, and now the kid was verbal, right? And still the story continues. I'm continuing to get updates on this, where every time we add a certain protocol, the mom reports about new gains. So this is a very fruitful interaction, where the clinician is in touch with what's happening, and we're advising the mom, well, now do this, now do that. The mom knows the technique well enough to just follow orders, and they don't have to sit in our office expensively. They can do it at home. They can afford it, and the child has probably made much more progress when all is put together in home training than he did in the in-clinic training. But
sure.
Of course, you the latter would not have happened without. I mean, the home training gains would not have happened without the clinic gains happening first. The in-clinic training happening first.
Right. Is there any downside of bringing this treatment in addition to other things that people are doing to address ADD?
Well, that's something that I'm wrestling with right now. We happen to be talking here at a time when I think we're making some significant breakthroughs in our work with autism. And it's just very exciting what's happening. But I was sort of implying in what went before that some choices need to be made about doing this training appropriately, this sweet spot training. The implication of the sweet spot is that everything else is not a sweet spot, right? That
mm-hmm.
that you're really better off when you do it right. And the further we go along in this training, the more we know, the more we know that that's true. In other words, we're finding the right way to do things, but implicitly, that's also filling in the blanks on the things you shouldn't be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're still on this hunt with Thomas Edison, who first found 2,000 ways not to make a light bulb. for us, it's not a one-time event, you know, that you succeed in making a light bulb and then, you know, then you're sort of done. It's a continuing evolution. But we're also filling in the blanks on things that we should not be doing, things that are not the right thing to do. So, and the further we go into this, the more clearly is this defined for us, the more definitive this comes, this demarcation between good things to do and not so good things to do.
Right, but it certainly sounds like, I mean, if one were to argue the tenets of, you know, doing this and or, you know, trying it, giving it a shot versus not at all, is, you know, is it readily easily for people to dismiss this, or is it simply saying, look, wait a minute, this is clearly an adjunct add-on to what it is, whatever other treatment that we're doing, and there really is no downside of giving it a shot, and there's always going to be some benefit. I mean, I'm a strong advocate of doing something over doing nothing. And if you've got evidence that shows that doing something is going to leave you in a better place in the end than doing nothing, give it a go.
Right. Well, not only am I positive in this regard, obviously we're making our living at this with this technique, and that's where our personal vote is. We believe in this very strongly. But I think the evidence is increasingly going in favor of giving priority to neurofeedback. Let me just answer that that issue with respect to ADD first and then autism second. In ADD, we know there's got to be an organic issue somewhere because the genetics tell us that, and we know they're physiologically based issues. But fundamentally, it is an issue of brain function. It's in the functional realm. And even if there are biochemical deficits, and even if the child is not getting the right diet, and even if they haven't taken care of heavy metals, and their digestion is not in order, and they get lousy diet, and so forth, we can still, by and large, largely get them to the point where the ADD is not obtrusive.
Mm.
And so, that being the case, it could very well be recommended. Now, this treatment is not cheap, but it should be recommended. You know, people should go through life with better brain function. This is an investment in the rest of your life, and sooner or later this should be done. And I say, why not do it sooner? The downside would be if people have, and we see this, people have such good success with this that they then do not bother with cleaning up their diet, cleaning up other things in their life that ought to be attended to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unfortunate. Now, with autism, the balance shifts just slightly. We know there's many more organic issues in autism. I mean, it's just a tougher condition all around than just ADD. And so you might say, well, once we know what those biochemical issues are, shouldn't the agenda be to take care of those things that you already know are issues, and I can sympathize with that with that point of view, but again, let's talk about what should come first. What we now know, given the way we've worked with autism here, just in the last 6 months to 12 months, we make such an impact on the quality of life in that child and in that family that we say, look. Do this first, just to help with your family life, just to help this child be comfortable in his body, be comfortable with who he is. But then, by all means, take care of the biochemical stuff and the biomedical approaches and so forth.
Sure.
It's just those are all slow. We have no quick answer to the biochemistry. Something, you know, we've all heard of the miracle stories where parents adopt one change. And oh, by golly, their child is so much better. But for the garden variety autistic child, that miracle story is not in prospect. They have to do a number of things for the child to flourish.
Right.
And we would say, okay, even recognizing that, even recognizing that those problems exist, and it probably determine the severity of the autism that's observable in that child, we would still say, take care of the brain first. Even though the brain is downstream of the problem, you know, it's the consequence of all these biochemical problems. It's not the locus of the problem. Just improve the quality of life of that child as quickly as you can,
right,
and then go take care of these other things.
Start a positive cycle. You mentioned here 20-hour solution or 40 sessions, 40 half-hour sessions. How much calendar time, how long would that take?
Well, that's a couple of 3 months. Now, what we'd like, if the parents can afford it, we'd like to have concentrated sessions, because what happens is there's an interaction, there's a feedback happening at another level between the parents and the child and the therapist. And so we need feedback from the parents and from the child, and if we don't get it from the child, we need it from the parents, on how the child is responding to every session. Because that guides our training to where we, can find and maintain that sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
The more often the parent comes, the better that feedback loop is. If a person comes only once a week, and then we ask the person, well, okay, how was he after last week's session? Well, they've forgotten that by now. How did he sleep that night? Well, they don't remember. If we see people at three times a week, people are much better reporters, and we need good reporting.
Right. We've only got about 5 or 7 minutes left here, and I just want to ask you, how are your clients' doctors responding to clients' desire to do this, and what does the insurance industry have to say with respect to this approach?
Doctors are sort of mystified by all of this.
Mm-hmm.
They see results, they're intrigued. Some of them feel a bit threatened, and so forth. So right now it's a mixed bag, because this stuff is not appearing in the medical journals. It used to. Years ago, there were some papers in Epilepsia and so forth in the neurology journals. But nowadays, this is essentially migrated to where their specialty journals and in the psychology journals, where they talk about biofeedback. So it's not taught in medical school, so it mystifies people, by and large, in the medical community. Some of them come on board and start doing it,
mm-hmm.
and other people quietly adopt neurofeedback, but they don't tell their colleagues. As for the insurance company, they are unfortunately have the mindset that they'd like to pay less, the less they can get away with paying, the better off they are. Which it happens not to be true, because if you can solve some of these problems, their costs actually go down. So the insurance companies are a mixed bag, but they've also, bought into biofeedback by and large. So whenever they think of, whenever we're dealing with problems that biofeedback is traditionally used for, which is sleep problems, anxiety problems, and problems of pain, we have no difficulty with insurance reimbursement. It all depends on the individual policy, of course.
Right.
Now, when it comes to attention deficit disorder, they'd rather just have the child be on Ritalin, and that's the easiest for them. Even though it's not the least expensive solution by any means,
sure,
over the course of years. Now, the way they rationalize it is, the family is not going to be their problem 3 years from now anyway. So the insurance companies are never oriented toward long-term solutions. And so the fact that that neurofeedback pencils out as a lifetime remedy doesn't impress them.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, the longevity of this. So a family does, 40 sessions or whatever it requires, and they've got some, change in their behavior, and they're really happy with it. Is it lasting?
Well, yes, and this is also instructive, because it doesn't always last. And if it does not last, then that's an indication to us that something else is amiss.
Mm-hmm.
That we've got to look at the biochemistry, we've got to look at family situation, family stressors, trauma, violence in the family, maybe the child is being abused. In other words, this ought to hold. This is just learning. This is just learning,
mm-hmm.
and it's learning at a... It's not like learning differential equations. This is learning at a deep level that the brain will never forget. This is like learning to ride a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if I ever get on another bicycle. I will never forget how to ride a bicycle. And this is like learning how to ride a bicycle. This is learning these basic regulatory skills that every brain must have. But also it gets to practice them every day. This is attention. We get to practice attention every day.
Mm-hmm.
and we get to practice falling to sleep every day. You know, all of these things get practiced. It's not like we get out of practice by not riding a bicycle. So the brain can't help but use these techniques that we teach it.
Right. And as you say, it's something that's very, natural and in tune for the brain because it does respond positively to, feedback about itself, and that we do get this opportunity to teach it these patterns within desirable ranges that it did not previously have reference to, and that can make dramatic shifts over time.
Right.
So in the final couple minutes here, for parents that are listening or adults that are listening that want some more information, could you please give us a website for the book, or where do people begin their inquiry to learn more about biofeedback for ADD?
Well, our sort of general portal is eeginfo.com, and my personal involvement is with the Brian Othma Foundation because it's a nonprofit that's trying to promote this, and that would be brianothma.org or eeginstitute.com. But the main portal they could just go to is just eeginfo.com. There's research there. They can go to a research site. There's a practitioner directory that they can go to. There are chatty articles about this that they can read. And there are lots of resources that sort of point to, that point out from EEG Info.
Excellent. So I just want to thank you so much for being on the show. The book is ADD, The 20-Hour Solution, Training Minds to Concentrate and Self-Regulate Naturally, underline bold the word naturally, without medication. And this is a phenomenal entree for understanding how to use EEG biofeedback or neurofeedback to help people with ADD, ADHD, and many, many other ailments where biofeedback can be beneficial to helping the brain to learn proper regulation and dramatically impacting behavior in natural and inherent ways. We've been on the show today with Siegfried Otmer, Ph.D. He is co-author of the book ADD, The 20-Hour Solution. Just one more time, throw out your website, and we'll please.
Yeah, the website's www.eeginfo.com.
Siegfried, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Just an absolutely phenomenal topic, and I really implore you to check out the book and really learn all of your natural options and, we always advocate at on Reality Sandwich to do your best to learn what other options there are to naturally impact our health and to not become long-term dependent on chemicals if we don't need to do so. So this is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist with Healthful Living, and you can find information on us at healthfulliving.org. This show and all other episodes of Reality Sandwich are available for free download at realitysandwichradio.com. We're going to be back next week with a best of Reality Sandwich, and then we'll return in 2 weeks for a show, I think, all about nonviolent communication and some excellent subjects coming up on Reality Sandwich over the coming weeks. So stay tuned next Thursday at noon. This is 89.5 KPOO San Francisco. Coming up next, Connecting the Dots.